You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, the United Nations predicts 3,000 migrants and asylum seekers will move into the Balkans each day over the next few months. I'll be discussing the situation with my special guests Raffaello Pantucci and Sebastian Borger. Then a group of former defence and foreign ministers want NATO and Russia to listen to each other and talk more effectively. But can better communication avoid all-out war? We'll have that debate here in the studio. And later on, ahead of Xi Jinping's visit to the US, America's Republican presidential candidates are outdoing each other to criticise China for the global market chaos. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the think tank RUSI, and Sebastian Borger, a London-based correspondent for German media. Welcome to you both. We'll begin with a story that has truly taken over media coverage here in Europe over the last few months, and that's the situation of migrants, refugees and asylum seekers. Tens of thousands of people fleeing war and poverty are pushing north from Greece through Macedonia and Serbia near Hungary, with Northern Europe for many the final destination. The United Nations is predicting today that 3,000 migrants will move into the Balkans each day over the next few months. And Sebastian, let us begin sort of east and we'll work our way west and look at how countries are coping with this or dealing with it. We've seen in recent days some absolutely heartbreaking pictures on the Greece-Macedonia border of Macedonian police using tear gas against, you know, people who have frankly suffered enough. And then we've got situations in Hungary where Hungarian police are preventing people boarding trains to go further on into Europe unless they have passports, which of course they don't. So they're now all stuck in train stations in Budapest. It seems that no one has come anywhere close to even thinking about a workable solution.
Well, first of all, I'm not entirely sure about the tactics of the Hungarian police. Seems to me to be slightly contradictory, because, of course, to some extent they want people to move on to countries like Austria, Germany, Sweden, who are in the vanguard of taking refugees at the moment. On the other hand, they're closing the border anyway. I suppose they are overwhelmed by the whole crisis as much as the Macedonians and the Greeks are. I mean, the Greeks, of course, you can, I have a lot of sympathy for Greece, which of course had to bore the brunt of these masses of migrants over the last few months. But simply opening the border and letting them all go to a neighbor which is, after all, very much poorer still, despite all the financial problems that Greece has, doesn't seem to me to be particularly ethical either.
Raffaello, there is supposed to be, and it's a bad system, which the more you think about it doesn't make sense anyway, but there is supposed to be a system whereby if you wish to claim asylum, you are supposed to do it in the first country within the European Union that you reach. Now, obviously, one can understand why Greece doesn't like this policy as much as, say, Finland does. But that's clearly not happening, is it?
No, I think clearly not. People are clearly just sort of getting shuffled along. But I think it's the dimensions of this problem that have gotten way out of hand. We've had similar sort of problems before. If we go back and think about where places like Lampedusa, the Canary Islands, are big focuses of landings, we're having huge amounts of people sort of arriving there, and it very quickly overwhelmed the system. In those cases, the Italians and the Spaniards sort of just didn't really know what to do, and they had these very small islands that suddenly had thousands of people showing up. in those contexts, we saw that there was some sort of an attempt to organize it. I think what we're seeing here is of a scale that seems to be much larger. And in countries that, frankly, have got all sorts of other problems that they're trying to contend with at the same time, and so therefore don't seem capable to respond in the sort of appropriate way.
And of course, Sebastian, these countries don't just have their other issues to respond to, they also have their own internal domestic politics to respond to.
I was interested in what you said about the EU treaty, you know, the so-called Dublin Agreement, which is obsolete, clearly, which tells you all about, all you need to know about European treaties. Whenever there is a crisis, you'll find a pragmatic solution. And so Germany was the one who said, let's forget about Dublin for the time being, and quite rightly so. The internal politics is you know, you have to take your population with you, and I mean, we see that in Germany with a small minority, fortunately, but there are people who are viscerally opposed to having any more foreigners in the country, and whatever television pictures you present them with about the terrible plight of these people in Syria and Eritrea and wherever else, they won't be moved. And so you've got to deal with that, obviously.
Sebastian, I want to stay with you just for a moment. You mentioned Germany and what's happening there. We saw Chancellor Angela Merkel today visiting an asylum shelter and essentially taking a stand against what she called these shameful anti-migrant protests that, yes, are a very small minority within Germany. But it was interesting that listening to, firstly, the fact that she's visiting a shelter like this, and then secondly, the language she's using, I'm struggling to think of another leader across Europe. Perhaps Matteo Renzi you know, has been talking in similar sorts of more sort of humane language, but that's it.
It's particularly interesting for us sitting here in London, isn't it? Mm. Where we are confronted with a government which is only ever criminalizing migrants, not the ones who are criminals, the ones who extort money and put them into unstable boats or force them to travel on lorries and all that, but the migrants themselves who are desperate. All we ever hear about are you know, marauding migrants who break into our country. I just think that the British government should be ashamed of itself. Of course, in Germany, I think the pressure which I detect entirely lacking in this country, the pressure of the media on Merkel is fairly high to get out there and do something. That's partly to do with our history, not just the World War history, but also our history 20 years ago when we had a asylum crisis, and of course we had plenty of people killed, and so people, I think, remember that from 20 years ago and say, let's hit these you know, right wingers and fascists over the head straight away before they cause, you know, injuries and death.
I mean, I think looking in the UK, the thing is that, you know, the UK has got an advantage of its natural geography. You know, the fact that it's an island nation means that, frankly, these problems are happening on the continent and they're happening far away. For Germany, it's impossible to sort of isolate itself in the same sort of a fashion. So I think that's clearly what's shaping the debate. I'm not sure I totally agree, actually, that the sort of media pressure here hasn't been quite strong. We've certainly seen heart-wrenching stories on a sort of daily basis in the BBC and in some parts of the press, admittedly not all parts of it.
But surely, Rafael, I mean, the media pressure here is more on the opposite way. If, you know, you look at most of the media and it's saying that actually what the government's doing is not tough enough. You know, there were calls, you know, just a month ago when everything was happening at Calais to bring in the army. Now, in Germany, that seems to be a different sort of message to bring in the army. But surely the media pressure here, Raffaello, seems to be far more, you know, against the government for what it's not doing rather than for what it should be doing.
Well, I think that here the conversation is much more, or the conversation that I see happening is, yes, on the one hand, there is a very sort of strong, robust response. We must do something about this and, you know, deploy these strong arm tactics because, you know, we're the way the UK is shaped and is dealing with this problem is something that they can do. But I do think that the other side of the question is, how do you deal with this? I think there is a sense that there does need to be a longer discussion about how you deal with this problem more fundamentally. And that is something that I don't think anyone has really got an answer to. But I think that that is a fundamental question. And here often the conversation seems to be much more about, well, how do we stop people leaving in the first place? Whereas I get a sense that on the continent in Germany, because of the immediacy of the problem that you're looking at and the fact these people are literally at your borders and coming across, here you've got groups of people in Calais who are trying to rush through the Eurotunnel, but that's in a very single specific location. It's not entire borders that are being sort of overwhelmed by these massive humanity, though I'm realizing I'm using slightly emotive language there, but I think that's sort of how it's sort of perceived. And so it's a very different sort of conversation. But here there is a discussion, and I do think it's quite a vibrant one. Well, what do you? How are we going to be able to deal with this problem at source? Because there is a realization that this isn't going to be the long-term solution, but something does need to be done to try to change this dynamic.
Well, wouldn't it be great if we had both? I completely agree that that part of the conversation isn't being had enough in at least my own country. I don't know about France and Italy and places like that. But, you know, they are there now. Mm. And this country has a proud tradition of asylum. I've just been reading the memoirs of one woman who came here on a Kindertransport, July 1939. That's what makes it even more baffling, to be honest, from my point of view. And, you know, you can't talk about, well, let's deal with it at source without putting anything forward. I haven't heard anything from the government. After all, it was the government that bombed Libya 4 years ago and then didn't deal with the fallout.
Well, let's talk about the issue of the problem at source as we're describing it. I mean, I must say, Raphael, I'm not quite as optimistic as you that there is that debate happening here. I'm struggling to remember the mentions of the situation in Eritrea by any government minister. I'm struggling to remember any frontline politician talking about the political talks about forming a Libyan government. All of that, all those things that might actually sort of help prevent people leaving in the first place, I'm not seeing.
I mean, on Eritrea, I agree. I can't think of a discussion that I've heard recently about Eritrean situation in particular, but I'll be honest, I haven't necessarily noticed it. But certainly on Libya and Syria, I think I disagree. I think that there is a very strong sense that there does need to be something done about these situations. I think you come up against the other problem there, which is that people don't really know what the solution to it is, you know, and it is just dealing with a very thorny problem. How are you going to resolve what's happening in Libya where you've got no real coherent government that you can actually sort of deal with or no one that controls it? And some of the places that you're most worried about where people are coming from are places that are controlled by groups that have affiliated themselves with ISIS in particular. So you're dealing with a situation that I think everyone looks at and says, oh my gosh, this is very difficult. But I'm not sure I'd agree that there isn't a lot of political capital and thought going into trying to look at these problems, though I agree that I haven't seen any solutions necessarily put forward.
Sebastian, do you think Germany is going to have much luck persuading its partners within the European Union that more needs to be done across all 28 member states? Because look, it was one thing when it was Greece and Italy and previously to a certain extent Spain who were bearing the brunt, because let's face it, you know, at the moment none of those countries have much clout within Europe. But now, looking at the situation in Germany, where Germany expects to receive 800,000 asylum seekers this year, do you think Angela Merkel has the clout still within Europe to say, look, we can't deal with this on our own? Finland, Slovakia, Austria, you know, everyone has to be with us. The Netherlands, you've got to
Great
take
Britain.
Your fair share as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Britain, you've got to take your fair share as well.
I think she's got the clout. Has she got the will to impose something? I suppose that depends on how desperate the situation gets. Short term, I suppose, dealing with the Balkan crisis that we now have, in addition to or sort of slightly away from the Mediterranean crisis that we had earlier in the year, I guess, you know, you could be, you'd have to be fairly generous to these countries. You'd have to offer help. and maybe offer a clearer perspective of EU at least affiliation or indeed membership. I think it's we've stalled a bit on that front. I don't know.
Okay, let's leave it there. We're going to stay in Europe, though. And a report by the European Leadership Network, a London-based think tank, advises that NATO and Russia need to talk to each other in more effective ways. The authors of the report are 14 European former defence and foreign ministers, and they point out there have been 66 close military encounters, as they put it, since March of last year between Russia and NATO, along course with NATO partners Sweden and Finland. And Raffaele, they're saying essentially both sides need to talk more to each other. Now, that's quite a simplistic plea in some ways, but they've got a point, haven't they? That even if times are tough and relationships are bad, there still need to be avenues of communications between the two sides.
Exactly. I think one of the key points this report seems to be making, I haven't read the entire thing, but it seems to be making the point that both the Russians and the Europeans have done military exercises recently that could be perceived as quite hostile and directed at the other. And there's a danger in having these sorts of actions happening at the same time as a very sort of frosty relationship between the two one capital on one side and numerous capitals on the other. There's a danger in having such incidents happening with such frosty relationships because there can be miscalculations when you're dealing with large powers like this can lead to open conflict. So I think their point is here that there is a need to open up a second channel of communication that maybe has faltered in the past years as we see the sort of, you know, demonization of Russia in certain parts of the Western press and in Russia a certain demonization of everything that happens in the West and conspiracy theories shooting in every sort of direction. So I think that there's a realization that these things have gotten very negative and the relationship has gotten to a very low point. And this is a call from these quite senior former officials to try to reestablish that kind of secondary web of contacts so that you do get your calculations right when you have some sort of an exercise and that people don't think that this is in fact maybe a conflict.
And Sebastian, this isn't just about bringing back the red phone to the White House and the Kremlin, so they've got a direct line to each other when need be. This is more about also a lower level and more spread out, having more conversations between officials on both sides.
Well, I'm to be honest, I'm not sure whether this report is at all relevant. I mean, we used to have rules, didn't we, about the integrity of borders. Who violated those rules? We used to have all sorts of contacts which Russia cut off. Now the Labour Party here in Britain is fond of talking about what we should have done in 1990 about NATO and the wars. Blah blah blah.
Only
doesn't
one
help
tiny
us.
Part of the party.
We are now here. Mm. We are now here. And I would really like to know about those 66 close military encounters. How many were done by Russian forces, and how many were done by Estonian or Swedish or Polish forces? Come on. I mean, this is the usual Putin lovers who think we've got. I mean, let's by all means talk. But let's not forget who started the whole thing. That was Putin.
I think that's a very good point. But I wanted to make the one point that I don't think it's really a red phone in Washington that we're worrying about. I think it's more establishing some sort of contact between some of the Eastern European countries that border with Russia and Russia. I think it's making sure that they each have a sort of understanding of each other and understanding of where each other's sort of concerns lie. I think for the Eastern Europeans, there's an important role that larger countries, larger NATO members like the United States and the UK and France and others need to make in showing that they have support and they will support them in any sort of confrontation with Russia. And I think that point is usually quite clearly made. But I think that, you know, Sebastian's 100% right, that frankly a lot of the blame for this does sit with Russia. But again, I think we do have to deal with the reality of the situation that you're facing. And the reality of the situation you're facing, that you are dealing with a Russia which is becoming increasingly sort of insular and erratic and doing all sorts of very antagonistic behaviours. But to make sure that that doesn't turn into a wider conflict, I think you do need to maintain some level of connectivity.
Okay, let's leave it there. When we're back, we'll be talking about the Iraq war, because it never goes away, and also about Republican candidates and their views of China. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city, you know. It's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Sebastian Borger and Raffaello Pantucci. Who is to blame for the disaster that was the Iraq War? According to former UK Labour Minister Claire Short, the government's inquiry into the war will find that everyone's to blame and no one's to blame. Short has expressed her anger at Sir John Chilcot's investigation, which still isn't out, saying the draft report is as big as War and Peace, yet of very, very poor quality. It's emerged that the report is likely to cast its net wider than former Prime Minister Tony Blair and his team, and Short herself is the first official mentioned within the report to speak out against it. Sebastian Borger, let's put this in context, of course. Claire Short was International Development Secretary. She was a fierce critic of the Iraq War. She threatened to resign beforehand. Many people who are opposed to the war say she actually should have, and if she'd resigned at the same time as Robin Cook, who resigned and made a very eloquent speech when he did, then possibly the vote might not have passed. It's going to be a little bit strange if even she ends up getting a bit of blame for what went on afterwards.
Well, let's start at first principle, shall we? This war was going to happen. The Americans were hell-bent on invading Iraq. Now, Tony Blair, for whatever reason, thought it's better for us to be involved than not be involved. So he wanted to take Britain into the war. This inquiry could only happen in Britain, of course. In any other developed industrial country, it would be Parliament, a parliamentary committee of some sort, doing that kind of thing. Raffaello is looking at me.
Well, I'm just
quizzically.
Thinking the U.S. didn't they?
The Senate committee.
Was that a Senate committee? Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an independent commission. No.
It was an independent commission, but it was
quicker. Sorry, okay, I'm wrong. You're right.
No. But what was interesting about that was it was all in public, pretty much, and it had a timetable. It was bipartisan, and it came out. Mm-hmm. And you know, unlike, for example, what's happened here, where this is going to be the fourth inquiry to concerning events surrounding the Iraq war, but this is the first one that's actually about the war itself. And Raffaello, there has been an awful lot of criticism because it has taken so long. You know, this started in 2009. That's 6 years.
Yeah. You know, this is why Claire Short's saying it's longer than War and Peace. I mean, they spent a lot of time writing this thing, you know. No, I think it has taken a ridiculous amount of time to come out. And if I've understood correctly, the hindrance seems to be the fact that everyone who's mentioned in the report has to get a chance of coming back and responding to the criticisms before they come out. And it's called the Maxwell effect for reasons that I'm not totally sure about. But I think this...
I know what it is, but it'll take three minutes to explain. Let's not get into it.
There's
a process where everyone who's criticised gets a chance to see their criticism before the report's published and respond.
Exactly. So I think this is what's held the entire process up, and there's been all sorts of, you know, surreptitious leaks in the media hinting that, oh, it's Mr. T. Blair who's holding it all up, or, oh, it's someone else. And I saw the chief of staff, General Houghton, seems to got some stick in the newspapers a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the reality is that when this finally arrives, I can't imagine it's going to tell us anything we didn't already know.
That's the thing,
isn't
it?
You know, and I just wonder, in some ways, I suspect that it's going to be, what the newspapers are going to be full of is whatever emotive adjectives Mr. Chilcot has injected into the body of the text around certain individuals. So, you know, I just don't know if this is really going to have a huge value at this point anymore. You know, I suspect that there's probably a few millions that have gone into this that probably could have been used with a better purpose.
And Sebastian, that's the issue, isn't it? Because it doesn't matter. We all know what happened in Iraq and in the run-up to it and afterwards. And what we know is obviously tempered by what our view is. We can't all necessarily agree on what we know. And that's another problem as well, isn't it? That whenever the report comes out, there are going to be some people who, frankly, won't be happy until Tony Blair is locked up in The Hague, and they'll say, well, this is a whitewash. And there'll be others who will say, well, this is, you know, they're in hock to the anti-war lot, and they've, you know, and they've brushed over a lot of the facts about Saddam Hussein and what he was doing. Everyone's already got their view. No one's going to change their mind when this report comes out.
No, I agree. On the other hand, I do think it started off as a worthwhile exercise. Mm. There are very high-powered and good people on the panel, no doubt about it. I trust them to come up with a balanced view. And I have to say, I slightly disagree. I find it interesting that beyond Tone, the Prime Minister at the time, that people are being blamed who we didn't particularly think of as blamed material, so to speak. You know, the bosses of the intelligence services, MI6 and MI5, I believe, as Raffaello pointed out, high military people, the defense secretary. So we're getting away a little bit from the view of the elected dictatorship that the UK supposedly is, and us are asking people, what did you do in the war or before the war? I'm still interested. Sorry to say that.
No, don't apologise for being interested. I'm sure it will be a good read as well when it does eventually come out, even if it is as long as War and Peace. Finally, let's talk about, with a heavy heart, about the Republican presidential candidates who are their latest target. Raffaello is China's president, Xi Jinping. He's due to be visiting Washington soon, but given the recent stock market turbulence, Republican presidential candidates are lining up to pin the blame for the global crisis on Xi Jinping. And Scott Walker, one of the candidates, is saying that he shouldn't be invited anymore. In some ways, Raffaello, I'm quite impressed that foreign policy is making such a big appearance in the Republican primary fight.
It's a very good point, and you'd question how many of these guys would be able to find China on a map sometimes, you know, not meaning to jibe at a certain group, but there we go. I mean, I think that it's, you know, the typical bombast of a Republican campaign. What remains shocking to me about it is that we're having these conversations at such a heated level 2 years before the election's even going to be called, you know, and we're getting this excited about it during the primary campaign. And I do, the one sort of serious point I take away from, less from this conversation, frankly, because China bashing is always a feature of the American political debate, no matter which side, frankly, you're talking on, is some of the comments we are seeing from some of the Republicans in their primary conversations. I can't remember which one it was, but one of them said that the Iran deal, no matter if he got voted in, he would scrap whatever deal came into it. And that is a potentially really negative message to be sending out, because should that candidate actually win, then frankly, any deal that has been signed between the United States and another country is potentially up for chop. And it would really make you question the sort of viability of the president or the United States' word. And that is potentially hugely negative. If you're going to go this far into a campaign to make such bombastic and aggressive statements about international relations and sort of scrapping treaties as soon as you come into power, you're going to start making other people wonder, well, why should we even start to think about having some sort of treaty? And what does America's word really count at all in the world anymore?
Sebastian Borger, is this just the wilder fringes of the Republican Party having a pop, or do you worry that this is just a little bit more nationalistic, which is a word we don't tend to use about Western countries, but it's a little bit more nationalistic than we would normally expect in a presidential debate?
I use it in my reporting on the United Kingdom all the time. there are wilder fringes, but there are also, some of them seem to be increasingly serious contenders. I mean, Donald Trump is whatever we think of him, is leading the opinion polls as far as the Republican candidate. I trust the wisdom of the US electorate in the end. And so I would make the same point. We're a number of months away from the election, and I simply cannot for the life of me see any of these guys actually get elected, whatever rhetoric they use. And to be honest, I mean, rhetoric is always part of an election campaign. In the end, when it comes to the responsibility of being in the White House, you'll have to adhere to certain laws of international international relations, one of which is Pacta Sunt Servanda. You have to keep, if the treaty is in force by the time they get into office, they'll have to stick with it.
Always good to end with a bit of Latin. Raffaele Pantucci, Sebastian Borger, thank you very much indeed. That was Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federico Romaniello and Aidan McLaughlin. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Chris Lord is next. We're back tomorrow, 1800 hours.